Welcome to Investigating Angel, an Angel rewatch podcast where we analyze each episode of Angel the series with no spoilers. We are your hosts, Leia
and Sarah,
and if you love Angel, this is the podcast for you.
Welcome back to Investigating Angel. Today we're talking about season one, episode 20, Warzone. Okay, yeah, so I've really been looking forward to this episode because it not only does it introduce a really, really interesting character, but I think the premise of this episode is one that I'm super surprised that neither Buffy nor Angel have attempted, or not, I guess I shouldn't say the premise, but like the whole thing with Alana turning into a vampire. Like, we haven't really had a main character turn into a vampire. I guess the closest you would get would be Angel, because when he turned from Angel to Angelus, like, it's pretty much almost as if he went into more of embraced more of his vampiric self, I guess is what you could say. Minor examples would be like Ford, but this is the first time it's been like someone that was so closely tied, like familially tied to one of the main characters. I don't know. I find this episode super fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, this episode is obviously really important because we get to meet Gunn, who's like, if you've watched the show before, he's kind of a staple on this show. I mean, spoiler, but whatever. But yeah, it's also just very interesting. I don't think we've ever seen just like a group of civilians fighting demons. Like, we have the Initiative over on Buffy, but that's completely different. This is like literally a group of kids, and it's like they've been around for how long? Like, I don't know. It's just interesting to think that there are other people out in the world that are fighting evil that aren't like Buffy and Angel's respective crews. So,
and they're people that have no supernatural tie. Like, these are completely normal people, and you can tell that with how they deck themselves out with gear. And it just creates this really interesting, because I mean, we're coming from Sunnydale, where if you do not have any direct tie to the supernatural, you aren't aware that it exists, or you just put your head in the sand and pretend that it doesn't.
I feel like that's what it is in Sunnydale. You just kind of pretend nothing's happening.
Right. And then here in this episode, you have these people who not only are they like forced to deal with it because of where they live and where their station is in life, but they're also actively seeking it out. And I don't know, that says something really interesting about these characters, you know? So Warzone aired May 9th, 2000, was directed by David Strayton and was written by Gary Campbell, which I looked up Gary Campbell because I was like, okay, what other stuff has he done? He's done a few mostly animated stuff, but this was the only episode of Angel that he wrote, which is really interesting. I'm always curious, like, why would you bring a writer on for one and then like never have him write again? So who knows? All right, so Tim Minear actually liked the concept of an entire subculture living under Los Angeles that you don't really see, which is a metaphor for the wealth stratification in LA. He says you'll have upper class neighborhoods and a block away poverty. The upper class people sort of don't notice the poverty or choose not to. He also liked the scene in which Angel is rescued from the meat locker by Wesley and Cordelia, who ask, why didn't you call us on your cell phone? Because it turns the concept of the action hero on its head a little bit. The defining moment of the episode, Minear thinks, is when Angel, rather than offer his help, instead indicates he may later need Gunn's help. And I mean, every time we come back to the concept of Los Angeles as its own character, I just find that super fascinating, because until you had mentioned that and read that quote to me, like, I think back in our first episode, Leia, I never really thought about that, but I'm seeing it more and more with each episode, and I just think that's such an interesting concept for a show.
No, I was just gonna say that I think also just the concept of like having these, I guess, other people fighting evil like underground is something that you, like we said earlier, you wouldn't imagine happening in Sunnydale, but you can imagine it happening in Los Angeles, because there's just, it's like there's no like limits to what happens in Los Angeles almost. Like you, anything you want to happen can basically happen here is what is the vibe that we've been getting this whole time, you know, even with the, oh, like the demons can be the helpless too. And, oh, there's like civilians that fight demons now. And, oh, there's maybe some demons who aren't like the worst. And yeah, it just makes sense that this would be a story that would be told in Los Angeles. And it has to be in Los Angeles.
No, I totally agree. And I really appreciate that they lean more into stories that can only be told in Los Angeles versus ones. I mean, there's going to be overlap. Like there's going to be things that we've probably seen them do over on Buffy that they do over here on Angel. But I appreciate that they're leaning into what makes Angel unique and trying to tell mm-hmm. those stories instead of just doing a repeat of what we've already seen. Yeah, I just appreciate that. So, okay, Leia kind of already like, you know, spoiled it, but I was going back and forth. I was like, should we say that Gunn becomes, you know, like a reoccurring character, like a main character? And I was like, you know what, might as well.
I think if like anybody has looked anywhere online about Angel the series, like you're going to see promotional stuff with Gunn in it. So,
yeah,
you know, he's going to be around for a while, guys.
Yes, he is. Which it's funny because my first watch of Angel, so I knew enough about Angel because, again, I watched Buffy for years and years, but I didn't know that much. And so I actually did not know that Gunn was a part of the crew. I don't know how I got away with that, but when I started watching Angel about 3 or 4 years ago, this episode came on and they introduced Gunn and I was like, oh, that's really cool. And then he kept popping back up and I was like, oh, how did I not know that there was another character on this show and that he pops up like at the very end of the first season? And mm-hmm. I just think that's kind of cool how they do that. All right, so Joss Whedon wanted to introduce another character who would be very different from both Wesley and Angel. And when writer Gary Campbell pitched the idea of street kids battling vampires, the character of Gunn was conceived. His character is named after James and Sean Gunn, who, you know, we all know who James is. James Gunn is the Guardians of the Galaxy director and I guess kind of like, I guess he would be the head of the DC universe over for Warner Brothers right now. And then Sean Gunn, who he's played a couple of demons on Angel so far. He played a demon in Hero and then the owner of that spa in She. Apparently Joss really likes James and Sean. Like they're close. And so he decided to name one of his characters after them. All right. And then J. August Richards III. So he plays Charles Gunn. Fun fact, he attended college with and co-starred in school stage productions with George Hertzberg, who plays Adam on Buffy season 4.
Oh, wow.
And with Danny Strong. So those three went to school together. Isn't that crazy? Like what a random like group of guys.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know about the other guy, but I, you know, Jay has gone on to like be in a few different shows.
Yeah.
He's like done a few things. And so has Danny Strong. Like Danny Strong obviously has had like an incredible career since Buffy and since the 90s.
Right. Well, Danny Strong has written 2 of the Hunger Games movies. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Like a really great career.
Yeah. I know. He's fantastic. I love his writing.
And I'm pretty sure Jay has starred in like Marvel shows.
Yeah. He was in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. He was a Nightlock, I think is this character's name.
Yeah.
And then I think most recently he was in Vampire Academy. That's right.
Yeah.
Yep. No, he's a great actor. And I follow him on Instagram and he's so fun to watch. And just watching him kind of come into his own the past few years, like with his fashion and stuff. Ugh, he's a great guy. And then I know we mentioned this in Eternity, but according to Tamara Gorski, who plays Rebecca on that episode, Eternity was the first episode that Joss Whedon showed J. August Richards to convince him to be on the show, which I think is really kind of cool.
That is a pretty good episode because you get to see like both sides of the main character.
Yeah, I know. That's one of my favorite episodes of season 1. And I feel like that would be the one that you kind of, like you said, you get a better picture of who Angel is.
Which is interesting because Angel introduces himself to that vampire. Oh, my name's Angelus. I was like, oh, we're using those names interchangeably now.
Yeah, that is a big moment. I think that's like one of the first times that is the first time he's done that, like as Angel. So, yeah, I'm curious to know your thoughts when we get to that one because I'm like, ooh, that feels really intentional that he did that right here.
Yeah.
All right. So I have a quote here from the book Reading Angel. And it kind of talks a little bit about J. August Richards' audition for this role and like his thought process going into it, and even kind of like a little bit about the climate with which this character was coming into, like, in media and in film. Because I mean, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Race is a huge part of this episode, and it's unfortunately, and fortunately in some ways, it's tied with J. August Richards' role on the show just in general because of the time period that it was in. I feel like if this show was written in now, it would have been very much like, this is a Black character and he's on the show and, like, you know, he's going to be his own thing apart from his Blackness. And I feel like back then it was like, if you're a Black character on the show, we have to like lean into that so hard and like, and kind of lean more into stereotypes and cliches instead of letting this person just like speak on their own. I don't know if that makes any sense. So the quote says, "The Warner Brothers' creation of character Charles Gunn came at a fortuitous time. Angel premiered in the middle of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Their charges of whitewash, a social statement by the Black community that despite their increasing demographics, television networks continue to represent a majority of white actors' stories and interests," which is true. "Few Black actors appeared in prime time, especially in continuous roles, and what limited screen time is given to Black actors frequently reifies stereotypical assumptions of Black cultural life. Gunn appeared as a guest star in season one, and then by season two had integrated into his role as Angel's ensemble cast. J. August Richards, the actor who portrays Gunn in the series, appeared in a variety of small television parts prior to landing his role in Angel, including guest roles on JAG, The West Wing, The Practice, Sliders, Clueless," which I didn't know he was in Clueless. I'm going to have to look for him now. "Chicago Hope, Nash Bridges, Diagnosis Murder, and The Cosby Show. In fact, his relegation to guest roles became a point of contention in his family. The young actor commented to the press that when I first started, I'd have two lines in a show and my family would say, 'When do you get to say more?' If only they knew how hard I had to work for those two lines." Richards struggled in the television business and it led to a test. He agreed to allow a journalist from the Los Angeles Times to test the concept of whitewash by secretly following around the young Black actor as he tried to break into the business. The journalist followed his career for an entire year, and fortunately, Richards landed the role of Gunn on Angel," which is crazy to me. I just, like, you hear these stories and then you see these characters and it's just, it's crazy to think that, like, how people could over, because he's a fantastic actor. And it's just so sad to me that there's this idea that you, if you're a Black actor or you're an Indian actor and you're anything other than white, therefore we have to have a role that's created for you, for your Blackness, for your, you know, whatever ethnicity you are, instead of being like, why can't we just let, like, your good acting speak for you, and who cares if the actor is a person of color or not? And I feel, I really do appreciate that our media tends to be leaning more in that direction. We still have a long way to go for sure. But it just makes me really sad to think that, like, it took him a very long time to find something that would work. Jay says, "What's ironic is that I don't think race ultimately had anything to do with me getting the part. When I auditioned, I heard that they were looking at white guys, Latino guys, Asian guys, so they didn't know where they were going to go with it. I don't think my parents were too happy when I announced that I wanted to be an actor. And then when I told them that I was starring in a show about vampires, they were like, 'Couldn't you at least get a role as a nice lawyer or something?' My mom always wanted me to be a lawyer or a priest. I think they were a little bit surprised by my career choices." He comments on his character a little bit more. He says, "Gunn is an activist, a renegade vampire hunter who leads his motley crew of fellow hunters on a personal crusade of execution for reasons that the audience is not yet aware of. He is a tormented soul and a lone ranger, much like Angel, but he has adopted a family of lost and disenfranchised who he will protect at any cost. It's almost like he's two people in one, a violent and aggressive warrior, but also someone who desires family and people close to him." And I was like, ooh, who does that sound like?
I don't know.
Maybe someone that, like, you know, this entire episode is trying to compare Gunn to, which we'll talk about in a second. Jay goes on to say, "Everybody on the set is fantastic and there are so many interesting people. I absolutely love working with David Boreanaz and Charisma Carpenter. I completely adore. She teaches me to dance." Isn't that so sweet?
That's so sweet.
He says, she's definitely one of my favorite people on the set. And Alexis Denisov is such a dynamic actor. He's phenomenal. There is so much I can see happening to this character. It makes me excited to think about all the ways he can branch out. Charles is a fantastic character. I really love his spirit. He's so pure and clean and unaffected. I love the extent to which he goes to protect the people he loves. I find that fascinating and admirable. And I just think about how this must have been such a breath of fresh air for someone who's struggling to get a meaty role. And mm-hmm. then you're given this, like, this must have been a dream come true for him. And then just talking about it real briefly, because I want to preface all this by saying, like, I feel like in a lot of ways, it's not my place to really talk about race that much, just because I'm white. I don't have the experience and stuff, but I do want to comment a little bit about it simply because I think to completely overlook it would be like missing a huge aspect of the show. But we have criticized over on Becoming Buffy, and not so much here, but we will, the show's lack of racially diverse characters for a while now. And I think that is like mm-hmm. the number one criticism that people have with the shows. And this episode feels like the Buffyverse writers attempting to dip their toes in the water of the topic of race in a way that's very different from how they've done it before. Like I think about Pangs. Yeah. And I think about even we just did New Moon Rising. Frequently, the Buffyverse tries to make a comparison between vampires and demons and minorities. Yeah. And it's really messy because it's like they're supposed to be the bad guys. So I don't think that people of color prefer to be compared to the demons and like, you know what I mean? Like it's just not okay. And so I know they try to be subversive, but oftentimes they end up becoming like really convoluted in the message they're sending. And so even though Gunn is a cliche in this episode, I think that Buffy also started as a cliche. So that's not saying that they can't go somewhere with this. So I applaud the Buffyverse for attempting to do that and doing it, I won't say perfectly, but doing it fairly well. So I don't know, Leah, what did you think about like the handling of race in this episode?
I feel like you said it, like you basically said it all. You know, I tend to agree that, you know, Gunn's introduction and like the entire storyline is very like, it's just like it reeks of like stereotypes everywhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah. However, I feel like Gunn as a character, like, I don't know if it's the way Jay plays him. I don't know if it's because I know what's coming later, but there's like a lot more depth to the character than just the stereotypes that he's
been
kind of given in this episode. So I don't know. I don't know if I was watching this for the first time and I didn't know all that I do know that I would feel the same way. But I mean, you could also look at the other characters who we're never going to see again. and those stereotypes like very much still apply to them. So I think it's an attempt that's like not perfect. But like you said, I think that there's like promise for like much better use of this character. Like moving forward, like there's like seeds of it already in this episode. So I'm excited to kind of see what comes next with Gunn because I think he's just such a great character. And just from the very, very first episode, like you can tell that he's going to be doing big things on this show. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. And I wonder if them knowing right off the bat that he was going to be a reoccurring character, it allowed them to expand so much more on his character and go in some pretty extreme places, knowing that they're going to build off of that. Because I was thinking about, like, you know, one of our major criticisms for Expecting and She is how they end up using Angel as the White Knight to save these women. And we're frustrated because we're like, no. You know, like you need to let these women save themselves and let them stand on their own two feet. And often Angel comes in as this white knight and we're like, okay. But then like how does the show get away from that? Because the show is about Angel. Right. And I appreciated so much that they didn't do that with Gunn in this episode. Like Angel definitely comes in at the very end and stops the gang war. But like he also admits that Gunn and his team could have done it on their own. They just would have probably lost a few more people. Right. And this episode centered so much around Gunn apart from Angel. I thought that was a wonderful and refreshing take that we haven't seen. That's been our biggest criticism for this season. So I was very thankful for that.
I agree.
Yeah. And I also really like that they're just like, you know, I don't need some middle class white dude coming in to save. Yeah. I was like, yeah. Where was this attitude in Expecting and in She? Yeah. You know, like, yeah, it's almost like the writers are like, well, we have our female show, so therefore we can have Angel save all the girls. You know, like, no, come on. Aren't you supposed to be subversive? Let the girl save you.
That's on Buffy. That's only on Buffy.
Only on Buffy, yeah. Come on. And then lastly, there are so many cool comparisons and contrasts between Gunn and Angel in this episode, like so many. I mean, both initially reject working with a team and want to go alone. And while we don't fully know what Gunn's motivations are yet, aside from, you know, Alana and then losing Alana, we can draw conclusions based on the parallels between him and Angel. I mean, Angel's fighting the good fight because that gives him meaning and purpose in his life. And now since Gunn has lost Alana, who like was his meaning and purpose, he's left without a reason for fighting. And Angel's words at the end imply that he wants to give him one. So I just think that that just gives us so much to go with the character moving forward, you know? And then of course we have the whole found family and even a little bit of like the father theme again there with Angel and Gunn.
Angel's everyone's father. Oh my God.
He is. I'm like, oh, now that I'm actually like looking for it, I'm like, it's everywhere, isn't it?
Like literally everywhere.
Yeah. I wonder what the overarching theme of this show is going to be.
Dads.
Dads, yes. Fathers.
Just one father. It's just Angel.
It's just Angel. At the top of the pyramid, it's Angel. Betty Angel.
Betty Angel.
All right. So we start off. We're in the bad part of town, as the script says. And I love how we know we're in the bad part of town. As if you couldn't tell.
Okay.
I love how they every time they want to show us that we're in LA, they always have us like underneath a freeway.
Yeah. like every single time.
Is that where part of town.
Is that where like bad people go to do bad things under freeways?
I don't know. I grew up in LA. I even wrote my notes. I was like, yes. Our quintessential shot under the 405 to show us that this is indeed the seedy part of town. I was dying. Of course, a siren going off in the background, and then there's a poor woman walking by herself. Like all the cliches, all like crammed into this one scene, which they do it intentionally because it's supposed to be kind of a reflection of even the beginning of the show when Angel saves that woman in the alley. Like we're supposed to really believe that Gunn is Angel. It's setting us up for that. Want, want. It's not Angel. It's Gunn. So we have Alana. She's going through the alley. Three vamps are stalking her. She stops. And then we have that moment where the vamps turn. They're like, you. And then we have like the panning up. And then then we think, it's Angel. And it's not.
Yeah, it kind of looks like Angel too. There's like the baggy pants and like the long coat or something. Yep. And then you're like, okay.
Yeah. The show even plays Angel's music too. And we have that you looking for something else or you expecting someone else, you know? Like the show is very aware. So there's a couple different reasons. I think the most obvious is that they were trying to fake us out and be like, hoo-hoo, look, we're being subversive. Matthew Mills, in his essay, Ubi Caritas, Music as a Narrative Agent in Angel, says this. He says, themes can also be interrupted, broken off abruptly, or changed in such an unexpected way that the music the viewer expects is not delivered, emphasizing an unusual situation. The teaser sequence to Warzone exemplifies this technique. As the vampires close in on the girl in the alley, a truck pulls up, the vampires turn around, and their leader sneers, you. Angel's theme begins, the camera tilts up from a man's feet, taking in a long, dark overcoat. As Charles Gunn's face comes into shot, the music breaks off, and he asks, you expecting someone else? Which we were. The sudden abandonment of the theme and interrupted harmonic progression map first and foremost onto our own surprise. But there is more than mere shock involved here. The underscore would seem to imbue Gunn with all the qualities associated by now with Angel. Gunn appears to be doing Angel's job, and the score at first implies that he is a hero for it. As it turns out, Gunn doesn't have Angel's heroism. He is not destined to fight evil in this way. He chooses to. nor is he seeking redemption through it. His reason at this stage is left unstated. Moreover, he is also reckless. His sister is sired by a vampire when a similar trap goes wrong and Gunn is forced to kill her. The interrupted cadence, in fact, calls into question Gunn's possession of the attributes that the music has helped to identify with Angel. Although the underscore plays to our initial expectations, expectations fostered deliberately through repeated music image association, its use here is in some senses super narrative, for it invites us to draw conclusions that the characters themselves do not, retrospectively indicating that this man is not Angel, and it makes its point by undermining its most immediate implication, namely heroism on the part of the character on screen. So very wordy, but basically trying to say they're drawing a parallel to Angel, but then they're also cutting it off to say, hey, it's different. So Gunn is his own person. He's not Angel, but he could be like Angel, and he has the heroism. He has all the things that we really love about Angel, like all those positive qualities. He has those things. What a way to introduce a character.
He's introduced almost as like Angel's equal.
Yeah, I love that. Also, I wanted to point out the script is hilarious. They're constantly referring to Gunn and his friends as youths or as kids. And all I hear is Schmidt from New Girl. I don't know if you've seen New Girl, when he's like youths the entire time. Have you seen New Girl?
I have not.
Why do I try? I even was in my head. I was like, she probably hasn't seen it. She's gonna be like, whatever. All right, I'll send you the clip later.
Okay, sounds good. I'm sorry, but I can almost hear it in my head.
You can almost hear it. You've never heard this character before.
The youths.
And I do want to say, like, I know these are supposed to be children, and everybody in the episode calls them children, but these are like 30-year-olds.
Yeah, these are not 16-year-olds.
No one believes them at all. Yeah. All right, so we have Charles Gunn there with a bunch of other guys. They have this awesome-looking truck that has massive stakes somehow attached to the front of the truck as they pull in. And then we cut to a penthouse apartment, and we have Wesley, Angel, and Cordelia entering in. Cordelia is talking about money again. She's like,
I smell money.
And Angel's like, no, she's not just saying that. He's like, hides them in the office sometimes and watch her. It's uncanny.
It's uncanny.
I really wish we'd had a moment where we'd seen Angel like hiding money and then just going and watching Cordelia come out and just like
sniffing it just for like a little serotonin boost in the middle of the workday.
All right. So they enter in and they're looking for David Nabbit. And I just, his name is hilarious because all I can think of is Dag Nabbit. Like,
yeah.
The script calls him a mousy-looking billionaire, a Bill Gates type. He's holding a tray of hors d'oeuvres, stands as they approach. Well, and first and foremost, I want to talk about how David Nabbit apparently was originally intended to be a reoccurring character, which we talked about before. Like, he does pop up a few times, but I think they were trying to figure out if they wanted him to be a part of the Angel Investigations gang. Because they were trying to fit him in. But David Herman, the actor who plays David Nabbit, had difficulty fitting the show into his schedule. And so the writers stopped writing scenes for him. Isn't that sad?
Yeah, that is sad. He's pretty cute.
He is.
Cute character.
He's very
although
endearing.
He kind of reminds me, he has like Joss Whedon vibes. Like he kind of looks like Joss Whedon a little bit.
Oh no.
And I feel like socially awkward like that. I don't know. Like
maybe it's good that he didn't stick around. We all would have been like, gotten a nick every time. Yeah. I will say, I'm curious why at this point they felt the need to continue writing more male characters, because I feel like they need another female character at this point. But
yeah, well, I mean, this is a very like male gazy show, I think.
That's true.
I mean, we've got to.
True.
Yeah. It's also interesting. So what I've noticed is like Angel, like David Boreanaz has always looked really tall in like on Buffy and in the first few.
Yeah. Not with Gunn
and not with Wesley. Like when those three guys are, I mean, we'll see them like at a later time, but it's almost like David Boreanaz like shrinks. Like he looks smaller next to Wesley and Gunn, like Jay and Alexis. And then I don't know. It's just very bizarre. But I mean,
over on Buffy, he was always in scenes with Sarah Michelle Gellar, who's like 5'3". But like,
yeah, the entire Buffy cast is tiny.
Just very tiny. And like, even Charisma's like taller. I think she's like 5'7" or something. So yeah, it just makes David look like just a little teeny bit smaller than he is. But
when we talked about this, what was it? In the dark when James Marsters came on.
Oh, yeah.
And he had to wear lifts.
James Marsters over is on like Buffy, 5 foot nothing. Like,
right. Well, over on Buffy, we have everybody so small. So you don't think about how short James Marsters slash Spike is, but then when he comes on to Angel, you're like, oh, he's tiny compared to all these giant men.
Yeah. They're not even that giant though. Like, David Boreanaz is like 6'1" or
David
something.
David Boreanaz has big shoulders, so he appears bigger, I think.
He just like takes up the room.
Yeah, he does. He has a presence.
Yeah.
I feel like every episode we end up talking about David Boreanaz's shoulders.
Shoulders, chest, arms. What else?
Yeah. We can keep going. Sadly, they are not on the display as they often are. I'm still thinking about The Ring, man. Such a good episode. Mm-hmm. Just for the shoulders.
The white tank.
Mm-hmm. God bless. Okay, moving on. And so you find out that Nabbit needs some help because he likes to play D&D with some guys, and they decided to take it into real life, and they ended up going to a demon brothel and someone took pictures.
Okay, but first, can we talk about how Angel thought that David Nabbit meant actual Dungeons and Dragons? He's like, yeah, I've seen a few.
And Wesley has to come in and correct and be like, he's like, I think he means the game, the board game. And Angel's like, what is that?
What do you mean? Not actual dungeons and actual dragons.
And Angel's like, gosh, I know what you mean, man. Those darn dragons had to replace so many tank tops and coats. Okay, but speaking of coats, I want to point out Wesley's significantly darker suit, which we have not seen him in before. And I feel like having this be the first scene of the episode that we see him and then having him dressed like that is intentional, because I think they're trying to emphasize a change with his character after the events of 5x5 in Sanctuary. Because after he was tortured, after he makes that massive decision to not help the Watchers Council and stay with Angel, and actually like doesn't give up Angel and Faith, that's a huge turning point for his character. And so I think they're trying to go a little bit more serious and a little bit, I won't say darker, but just they're taking away the slapsticky element of his character a little bit more. So I just thought that was interesting.
So Sanctuary was basically Wesley's I Will Remember You.
Just a lot less tears.
Accepting his mission. Yeah, like a lot less tears.
Yeah, accepting his mission. That's a good way to put it. I agree with that. All right, so Nabbit says that the security people have already identified the guy with the pictures. It's Lenny Edwards. They just can't find him. He mentions that if the stockholders found the pictures, that it would have major repercussions probably with his finances. And Cordelia's like, we'll be really discreet. We'll mingle for a few hours so that no one suspects. And Wesley and Angel are like, oh, joy. Yay. This is exactly what I want to do with my evening. And then Nabbit says, I moved to LA. I thought it was all glamour and valet parking. There's a whole world here that no one ever sees. And then immediately, of course, we cut to the seedy alley, the exact opposite of this ritzy side of LA. And it's moments, again, like this that remind me that LA is a character and it has multiple sides. And I thought that's so interesting how there's even a comparison with LA as the city and Angel. Mm-hmm. As a character who has two sides, and how there's the two sides of Angel, the two sides of LA, and like, I don't know, there's like a common theme of like the duality of people and both their sides. And I don't know, it's just, I'm so excited to talk more about it. Critically Touch says this about David Nabbit. They said, David represents the social side of alienation and living as an outcast, a Revenge of the Nerds style dream come to life, where the antisocial dungeon troll of an RPG gamer has grown into a successful businessman, having made billions. However, he still can't talk to girls. He pays people to attend his parties, has no true friends of his own, and lives a fairly solitary life driven to solicit sex workers. I felt a genuine touch of sympathy for poor David, and clearly a clearly decent man who is limited in life because of his own flaws. In that sense, he's not unlike Angel, who is too right when telling the con man in the alley how he'll never have what he really wants. This is also the only scene that gives Nabbit's plot a practical relevance, leading Angel to the kids and providing a parallel to the two plots that Angel carries when he leaps from one plot to another, the contrasting of these outcasts, which I really liked because you have Nabbit, who like obviously leads a very privileged life, but he doesn't know his own place in the world. And so I liked that comparison with Gunn and Angel and Wesley and Cordelia, like all these people, including Nabbit, that no matter where you fall socially, like it's so human to not feel like you belong. And that's what links everybody.
That's really the biggest theme of like the Buffyverse in general, really.
Mm-hmm. Which, and again, I mean, we go back to Out of Mind, Out of Sight, the first episode that really kind of fleshed out Cordelia's character. And I think about that moment that Cordelia talks with Buffy and says she could be surrounded by so many people but feel totally alone. And I think it's interesting that that's probably how Nabbit feels in this moment too. All right, so we jump back to Gunn battling vampires. This is a pretty like interesting fight. It's very intense. And the different weaponry that they're using, you could tell it's very crude. It's stuff that they've just put together. They seem like a well-oiled machine. They know who does what. Alana like sits back by the truck with Bobby as they use this really cool like catapult thing that shoots these, I guess they would be stakes at these vampires. Like
flying stakes.
Unfortunately, Bobby gets hit. And then we have them loading everybody into the car and Gunn tells them, no, don't go after them yet. And they take off. Something of note is special effects supervisor Lonnie Peristeer actually refined the dusting effect that you see with vampires in this scene. It becomes a little bit more sophisticated. Apparently this technique, which costs $5,000 every time you see a vampire dusted on screen. Yes, it depends upon a CGI skeletal frame surrounded by simulated dust, carefully matched to a projection of the live action footage. This allows for a complete organic transition from vampire to dust, and they were able to kind of refine it a little bit. And I mean, go back to season one of Buffy, and this is already like worlds better. But
oh yeah, it was like a poof of dust back then.
I crack up. I think it's Welcome to the Hellmouth or The Harvest where Darla like drops down a head. Either after she dusted someone or after she like turned from vamp face, like
yeah,
come quite a ways. All right, so the vamps end up getting away and the rest of them, the war wagon, end up going to their base. They go inside and it's an abandoned slaughterhouse, and there you can see there's a bunch of kids. The script says ranging from early teens to early 20s in the areas, as well as some older street people. There are mattresses along the walls and a couple of fires burning in 50-gallon drums. And I mentioned this earlier, but I really like the idea that these kids don't have the luxury of ignorance that we've seen in Sunnydale. I think that also kind of speaks to the class dynamic too. When you don't have money, when you don't have the privilege of being able to just turn a blind eye, this is the realities of these people.
You can't just run into your house and close the door.
Exactly.
You don't have a house.
They don't have a house. Right. And I don't know. I just thought that was really, really fascinating. So Bobby is not doing so well. We have Alana telling Gunn that he needs a doctor. And it's really interesting because the script had Gunn not responding to Alana. So she says he needs a doctor and Gunn was supposed to glance at her, then move away and then go tell his friend James that they need to go do something else while Bobby died on the floor. And it was supposed to come across as super cold. Like Gunn realizes that this guy's going to die and is like, all right, on to the next. And the way that they blocked it in the episode, they have Gunn actually there having his hand on this guy as the guy passes away. And I thought that that choice was so much better because they were showing that while Gunn, like he does kind of have a cold exterior and still wants to get things done, there's a part of him that genuinely cares about these people, which I thought was really important. Then we move back to Madame Dorian's, the demon brothel. Hmm. Okay. Did you see the girl with the co?
Oh, with the coat. No, I thought you were going to say the girl with the girl's in the opening credits. Is she not?
Is it
the girl with the hair?
Is that part? Yeah. It's the porcupine girl.
The porcupine girl.
From the opening credits in Angel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I did not even notice that. I was so distracted because I saw a girl with the co.
I did not notice that at all.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
So IMDb says, when Angel first walks into the brothel, we see a female demon from Odentai from episode 13. This implies that Jira and the other refugees have assimilated into society, perhaps due to Angel warning the males of their world to stay away, which is kind of cool.
Wow.
I did kind of crack up at all the cat noises. Did you hear that? Like, there was like, and like all sorts of stuff happening inside the brothel. There was like tons of like cougar and panther. And I was like, what is this? It was really funny.
What kind of demons are these?
I don't know. It was the funniest thing. Next time you watch it, go and listen for all the cat noises.
Okay.
All right, so Madame Dorian's like, we don't do vampires, sorry. Angel's like, I just came to talk. He shows the picture of Edward, and he's like, do you have one of these girls that would know who that was? And so they grab this porcupine girl, pink porcupine girl named Lena, pull her over, and we have the look, Ma, no hands moment as Angel
looks supremely
uncomfortable over there.
And then he just grabs her tail. I was like, okay, all right.
Yeah, well, the script says – Lena holds her hands up in the air. Angel stands very still, looks at her wryly. He's being groped. He reaches down out of frame, holds up a prehensile tail, and the script says, if possible, it should be erect-ish, twitching and flicking.
Oh.
Yeah, once he holds the photo up and everything and says, I'm looking for him, Lena's tail, and it says, if possible, droops in Angel's hand even as her expression fails.
Naughty.
They're like, how can we show that Angel has an erection without actually showing?
Oh my God. Well, that's very interesting.
I'm surprised it wasn't Tim. You know, honestly, if Tim Minear had written this script, I think it would have been a lot spicier. So
I think it would have been a lot more obvious. Know. Definitely. Yeah,
probably. Right. All right, so Lena gives them information on where this guy is, and then we jump to the abandoned slaughterhouse, back to Alana and Gunn. And then I just really appreciate even the camera work in this scene. It's very shaky cam. It feels very gritty, like you're here and it's a suspenseful versus the very polished way that the camera moves when you're with Angel and Wesley and Cordelia. Just having those like little contrasts really it's a unique way of telling the story, and I just enjoy it so much. So Alana says, gee, we need to talk. She says, what happened to Bobby? And Gunn says, no, we don't talk about that. It's done. He tries to end the conversation. She says, we're dying here, Gunn. And he says, everybody dies. I just want to make sure when we die, we stay dead. And she says, you're getting reckless. He says, I do what I have to do. And she says, no, you do more than you have to do. Which again, this is setting up for that conversation they have at the very end where she's like, hey, I can help take that burden from you. She's basically confronting him and saying, hey, you're intentionally going and antagonizing these vampires. They left us alone. They are leaving us alone. And then you're going and you're baiting them out. Like there's something in you that like enjoys this. She says that you can't go another day without getting a little death in, could you? And he says, you think I like this? And she says, no, I think you love it and you won't be happy until you get as close to death as you can. He says, you're wrong. So then we jump to Lenny Edwards in the alleyway and Angel doing what he does best, which is intimidate random people in alleyways and like, you know, do all sorts of sketchy dealings out back. And I gotta say, he was a little bit more vicious in this moment. And I think part of that is because they're trying to fake out with Gunn sees and be like, oh my gosh, this vampire is a huge threat and everything. But I don't know. I was like, he just has pictures and we have no tie in to David Nesbitt. I was like, save your aggression maybe for someone who like actually Angel's is really, really bad. Like at least just
going too crazy for a minute. Angel doesn't have time. He needs that check.
Yeah. He's like, quick. I got paid a lot of money. I really need to make sure that I do my job here. Also, I felt like Lenny Edwards kind of looked like Michael Keaton a bit. But anyway, okay. So Angel interrogates Michael Keaton. And he's all like, what do I want? Love, a family, a place on this planet to call my own. I was like, oh, this was very honest and specific and vulnerable of you, Angel. Like, are you okay?
Maybe he's just telling him what he wants to hear. Maybe that's not really what Angel wants. Maybe. Well,
I love that Edwards is like, what? At the end, like, why are you telling me all this, man? Like. So then he asks for the pictures of David Nabbit. And as this interrogation goes on, we have – and then Angel, like, you show me yours. I'll show you mine. It was just this moment was very odd. I know they were trying to make him super aggressive for Gunn's first reaction to be like, oh, my gosh. But I just was like, whoa, calm down there, Angel. It's very weird.
It's a little bit Angelus-like even. Mm. Like, very, like, sassy, very, like mm-hmm. – aggressive. That's very Angelus.
All right. So Gunn sees Angel, comes around just in time to hear Angel say that now I'm from around here. In fact, I'm moving in, taking over. Of course, the things that Gunn's going to hear. Angel says, I'm going to be back tomorrow. I want those pictures. Gunn's like, oh, he's moving in. He's not going to stay too long. And then we have dun dun. His gun looks like super sinister and it blacks out. Then we jump to Cordelia and Wes talking to Nabbit. Nabbit's writing them a massive check. Both Cordelia and Wesley are like completely shocked. And so then Cordelia feels the need to kiss up to Nabbit because of the amazing check. And she just puts her – well, she puts her foot in her mouth. by talking about how Nabbit's name sounds good in her mouth. And Wesley looks like he's like just gonna vomit all over the floor. He's like,
Wesley's like, there must be a mistake, sir. This can't be right.
All right, so the next day, it's supposed to be like the next night, Edwards is waiting for Angel at the same spot as before. He gives him the envelope, and just as Angel's reaching for the envelope, a demon comes out, and the script calls it a mofo demon.
Interesting. Why is that?
Because maybe it's massive. I don't know. It says Angel spins around to see a huge mofo demon who smiles as he's uppercutting Angel.
Interesting. Very interesting.
All right. So Angel and Mofo are – I can't get over that name – are fighting. Angel's getting his butt whooped. And Edwards is just sitting there like leering the entire time. We have some really cool moments where I think at one point Angel like spins around a light lamppost or a light post and comes back, hits Mofo, ends up knocking him out and grabs the pictures and is just about to take off but is like super duper winded when a massive stake comes and narrowly misses his heart. And we turn around and we see that truck that has a pneumonic stake firing cannon is what the script calls it.
Intense.
And Gunn and Chain are in the process of reloading. Angel pulls the stake out of his shoulder. They run. And then we have just a series of shots of Angel running through the street into a building. At one point, he gets into the building, shuts the door, and is like, oh, okay, I'm good. And they ram the truck into the door, and it narrowly misses Angel, so he has to take off again. He hits a bunch of booby traps, or like narrowly misses the booby traps. The script says, Angel's look says it all. What the fuck is going on here?
I mean, yeah, these are some pretty great traps that they set up. It's like a yeah. Home Alone type of deal.
Well, and the fact that he was being attacked by this massive demon and he was pummeled pretty badly and now he has to go and escape from these guys, it was set up very well. A kid suddenly leaps onto Angel. Angel flips him over. The script says Angel grabs the kid and is about to pound him when the kid looks up and Angel suddenly sees the face of a frightened 16-year-old. Instead of hitting the kid, Angel pushes him away. Hurting and confused, he's being hunted by children? Question mark. Which I had to go back because I was like, was that a child? And then I was like, no, that was definitely a full-grown man.
We'll just pretend. Everyone just looks a little bit older in LA.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's why Cordelia has aged up astronomically, right?
Yeah.
Then a bunch of the gang end up attacking Angel. Angel gets the best of them and grabs one of the last attackers, and it's Alana. Angel asks what they're playing at, and Gunn says, we're not playing. So Angel decides to let Alana go. As she moves away, she ends up tripping over a tripwire, which Angel sees just in time for him to put out his hand, and he saves Alana, and immediately everyone takes note. And you can tell this is kind of the last thing they ever expected from a vampire who's basically their mortal enemy at this point. He says, for some reason, I get the impression you don't like me. Maybe I'm just overreacting.
Angel's really sassy in this episode.
He is so sassy in this episode. Man, man's really really upset that he has to go out and do all this stuff for Nabbit. He's like, the powers to be didn't even give me this vision. I'm doing this for free.
Yeah. Well, they're getting paid handsomely. Come on now. Come on. Put some respect on David Nabbit's name.
To Angel, he's like, no, I don't care about the check. It's about earning my redemption, and the powers that be haven't even given this to me, so I don't even know if this is going towards my soul or not. Angel is telling them that, you know, we're fighting at the same side. I didn't come here to kill you. Gunn doesn't want to hear anything. He's like, you're a vampire, so why would we listen to you? So they take off, and the next day we have Cordelia and Wesley helping Angel get all bandaged up. And they're also looking at the photos that they got of Nabbit. I love that Wesley's staring at this photo and Angel takes one look at it and goes, it's upside down. Where have you been, Angel? What places
have you visited? He's lived a very long time. He's probably been to a lot of, you know.
A lot of what, Leia?
A lot of upside down brothels, obviously.
Upside down.
And then poor Wesley's just like, I don't understand. Please.
Wesley's
like
poor virgin eyes over there.
Oh my God.
Poor Wesley. And Cordelia's like, how does it feel? And Wesley's like, I can't possibly imagine it was pleasant. So Cordelia says, you need to rest. You look, Angel's like I've been beaten and stabbed. And she's like, you want to see the check again? She's probably thinking, it makes me feel so much better. You should sniff it too. It'll make you feel amazing. So Angel says, I want to find those kids. He tasks Wesley and Cordelia with the job of going and finding out where they live. All right, so now we're in the vamp hideout. This scene, interestingly enough, was supposed to be like really, really far back in the episode. It was originally going to be right after the scene with Gunn and Alana talking, where she says, you're being reckless, and it was supposed to jump to the vampires. But for some reason, they decided to move it all the way down here. So I don't know why. In his book on the mythology of vampires, Peter Day points out that the depiction of vampires as gang-like is a unifying characteristic of the LA subgenre, which includes, among others, The Lost Boys, the Blade films and television series, and Blood Ties. In this episode, gang violence is presented as a conflict of race. The racially diverse humans led by Gunn battle the uniformly vampire gang, who are presented as fascist skinheads looking to maintain the purity of the blood supply. Oh, there's that Nazi reference again. Their shared vampirism unifies the gang and provides them with a sense of community identity in a city whose urban sprawl has led to social and cultural segregation of communities. And I thought that was really interesting. Like, this whole scene is about how the vampires don't even really want to eat these guys because they see them as inferior, which again is like another layer of metaphor on race. You probably didn't do this, but every time Knox said street trash, I kept thinking about Aladdin where he's like, street rat scoundrel, take that. No? Oh, you didn't grow up watching Disney. Dang it. No. Okay. Someone out there hears street rat too. Come on, guys.
Sorry.
It's okay. The list is getting longer.
I mean, even if I had, I probably wouldn't remember.
Now I'm going to have that song stuck in my head the entire time. So Angel gets information from the vampires on where Gunn and the crew are. We have Alana trying to feed Gunn and take care of him, which again, it's little moments like this that just make the end so much more heartbreaking because she's still trying to take care of him. All of a sudden, a bunch of, I think it's like tear gas comes into the room. Gunn immediately tells everybody to get out, and Gunn and Chain stay in to face the vampires. And again, this is broad daylight, so this is highly unusual. The rest of the gang ends up getting outside, and Gunn realizes there's nobody, which means it's a trap. And so he runs out just in time to see Alana getting pulled into a van by a bunch of vampires. They're like completely head to toe covered in masks and everything in order for them to go in broad daylight. And then we have, this might genuinely be the most terrifying scene of Angel yet, where you have Gunn jumping onto the back of the van and looking inside the back of the van and seeing his sister being torn into by vampires. That is so sad.
Yeah, it was definitely heartbreaking. And again, it makes like the later scene even worse. Like, you really, I thought they did like just such a great job of like setting up that relationship in this one episode, so that when he has to kill her at the end, it's like kind of hits you. And it really marks like it's a big mark on like in Gunn's character. It's a big like characteristic of his moving forward, I think. Yeah. Like it had a big impact on him is what I'm trying to say. Wow, can't find my words.
Yeah. No, and I think you're right. They did just a great job of showing the love that these two have for each other and just the deep connection, but also how Alana in a lot of ways is kind of the glue. And I think the vampires even mentioned that, talking about how she's the heart of the gang and how she kind of keeps everything together. So this is just, I mean, and the fact that she's screaming for Gunn and he's helpless, he can't do anything. And then you have the vampire like look up with her blood dripping off of his face and then just pushes him off. I mean, how helpless must you feel in that moment? And again, the intentionality of having them, the vampires, attack them in their lair and do a fake out and corner them. They did the exact same thing that Gunn had been doing the entire time. And so the sadness of this whole thing is that it didn't have to be this way. Gunn, if he hadn't been antagonizing the vampires, they probably would not have taken Alana. And so that just makes it so sad. All right. So we have the scene where Cordelia and Wesley are looking for the young people's hideout. Cordelia's trying to sit and imagine and pretend she's watching a very buff lifeguard while Wesley is left with the cold, hard, naked truth, which is the homeless man. There actually was a part of the scene that was cut out where Cordelia had to go distract and talk to the homeless man while Wesley went to look at all the electrical cords and wiring to see which building was theirs. And apparently there was a line that Cordelia, like it cuts back and forth between Wesley and Cordelia, and it went back to Cordelia, and it says, Cordelia says, "No, believe me, I understand. It's terrible to be left by someone you love. I mean, I've never been left by someone I've loved, but I have left several people who loved me."
That would have been cute scene to see.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I understand why they took it out. Although mm-hmm. – do you think that Cordelia loved Xander? Because she was pretty heartbroken when she found out that he cheated on her.
I think she cared about him. I don't know if she loved him, honestly. I feel like Xander and Cordelia was very much like that high school like relationship that is kind of shallow, but like, I don't know. Yeah.
It feels really deep in the moment, but then when you get out of it and look back, you're like, oh, that really was just like puppy love.
Exactly.
So Angel finds where Gunn and the rest of the guys are. He finds the sentry. He says, "Ask me in." The sentry invites him in. And I love as soon as they get in, everyone looks at the sentry. Like Gunn gives them a look and he says, "I suck, okay?" Relatable.
It was just weird. I didn't like – so anywhere that like you say is your house, like a vampire has to be invited in.
Yeah, that is a good point. Is that not? I guess
it's a public space, technically.
Is it? But is it no longer a public space because people live there?
Maybe like you have to live there for like 60 days for a vampire to like not be able to like enter. Like,
I'm just so confused why like on Buffy, Spike can enter into Willow and Buffy's dorm room.
Because Spike has special rules. Well, he can't technically.
Oh yeah, Willow said come in.
Willow said come in. Yeah.
Oh, just like, okay.
Yeah. You have to be okay. You still have to be invited in, yeah, at the door. But that's more understandable because it's like an apartment building type of situation where there's like they live in like one of the units in a building, but this is just like a factory, an abandoned place. So,
yeah, the magic just knows that people live there, I guess.
Maybe it's just like squatters' rights or whatever. Isn't that a thing where like if you move in somewhere it like becomes yours?
Yeah.
Or it doesn't make sense.
Or it doesn't make sense. Well, and now that, you know, the sentry has invited this guy or invited this guy. Now that the sentry has invited Angel in, Angel will be allowed to enter into any home that the sentry lives in for the rest of his life,
supposedly. Yeah. Allegedly, that's the word on the street.
Oh my gosh, stupidest rule ever. All right, so Gunn says you don't want to be here. Angel's trying to like ward him off from going after the vampires, and then Gunn has this Such a good line. I don't need advice from a middle-class white man that's dead. You don't know what my life is. You have no idea what it's like down here. Angel ignores that because he's like, how can I argue with that logic? He says, some of you will die, maybe all of you. And they're like, people die all the time, some from talking too much. And what struck me so much in this moment was how Gunn is not acting any different than before Alana was taken. Like, he's obviously concerned, but in his mind, it's kind of like, this is just business as usual. And I wonder if there was this idea in Gunn's mind that he's done this so much that, like, Alana will be fine. Like, she can't possibly, you know, she wouldn't be dead. She wouldn't, you know, I don't know. It was just, I expected him to be a little bit more frantic, and he wasn't.
Or maybe he's just really good at staying focused. I mean, he brushed off that other guy's death like pretty quickly because he has things that he has to do. And he's very like tunnel visioned, like, okay, this is what's next. We have to get this done. Kind of like Buffy is in a lot of situations too.
Yeah. And I mean, in this scene, like, Gunn bests Angel twice. For, granted, the first time he was pretty severely wounded, and here he's still kind of like getting over it all. But I mean, Gunn pulls up the blinds, immediately like blinds Angel and pushes him out, and then pushes him into this closet and locks him in. Like, Gunn is shown to be extremely capable, and we know that Angel is not an easy demon to fight. So, although I will say, I wrote in my notes in that moment when the window crashes open and then you have the sun that blasts on Angel, I said, I feel like, and I shudder to suggest such a thing to your poor ears, Leia, but I feel like that should have killed him. That was a lot of sunlight.
Yeah. I mean, he also walks in like full on sunlight in the office. So I think he's like,
he's becoming immune to the sunlight, you
know? Yeah. Like, maybe just like small bits of exposure to sunlight make a vampire immune to it. I don't know.
Yeah.
Could be maybe interesting.
That's what it is. His vitamin D levels, you know, are low enough that he just absorbs it all or something.
Imagine.
No. They're like, here's a special ring, Angel. Now you can go out into the sunlight all the time.
It's called sun therapy. Give Angel some sun therapy.
He's been like slowly going out bit by bit to, like, you know, test his intolerance to the sunlight.
Yeah. Well, it's like a vaccine, right? Like, you give – it could be like that. Like, you give him little bits of, like, this thing that could be very harmful to him, and eventually his body will, like, I don't know, acclimate to it and not be – not reject it anymore.
That's what it is.
Cracked the code, guys. I just figured out how we could get vampires out in the daylight.
Because clearly that's what's happening with Angel. I mean, we have all the way back in, you know, Welcome to the Hellmouth and the Harvest. Angel couldn't even be in the tiniest bit of light. Mm-hmm. And now here he is.
He's just walking. He's walking in twilight.
Yeah, there's times where the sun is literally rising and he is walking down the street as if, you know, no big deal.
It's cool.
Anyway, all right. So we have the war wagon, as the script likes to call it, and Gunn. They have run into the vamp hideout. It's interesting that Gunn says, hold up, give me 10 minutes to check it out. Like, he wants to go in first. He really does have a death wish, doesn't he? Chain says, what do we do if you're not out in 10? Gunn says, come on down and kill anything that moves. Meaning, if I've turned into a vampire by then, kill me. Down to the vamp hideout, we hear, of course, it's always like some creepy girl singing. We hear humming, and it's Alana. And she says, hey, big brother, what took you so long? And he says, oh, God, you're not, thinking she's not a vampire and not dead. And then he gets close and says, dead, and realizes, oh, you are. And wow, what? This is just, it's chilling. It's so powerful. And I know I mentioned at the beginning, but like, we've never seen this before on a show. And I'm so surprised the writers haven't pulled this out yet, because I feel like this is such a compelling way to push your character in a direction, especially when it's someone that is so close to them. But even with Angel and Angelus, which is probably the sole exception to this, we had the hope that Angel would come back eventually. This is a gut punch because, like, Alana's gone. There's no, we have no hope of Alana coming back. The script says that Gunn's first joy at seeing her degenerates into grief. And Alana says, no, don't be sad. I'm not. He says, they killed you. And she says, do I look dead to you? I'm stronger and faster and better than ever. Want to see. And then she pushes him back really fast and really hard. And David Strayton, the director, suggested to Michelle Kelly, the actress, that in the scene where Alana pushes Gunn onto the ground, she should enjoy that more. And so that's where the laugh came out. Kelly says, the director knew at that point her character was relishing in all this newfound strength and freedom, even if it was for evil. So she decided to just ad-lib that laugh, which is just chilling. Michelle Kelly, who plays Alana, also said that she literally shouted with excitement upon reading the script. She says, getting to play someone as unrestricted as a vampire is a thrill. Kelly found that the vampire makeup and prosthetics, they were uncomfortable, but the most difficult aspect of the role was Kelly's pre-existing friendship with J. August Richards, which made a part of me not want to hurt him, Kelly explained. She said that she twisted that connection by imagining the isolation and raging despair her character would feel after being made a vampire. All I wanted is my brother. That's where I got the impetus to go into that ugly space. It was just the other side of loving, which I like her interpretation of saying she still loves her brother, which is, I think, completely consistent with what we've seen from vampires. It's just twisted. It's the other side of that.
Well, yeah, that's basically what Darla said at the end of The Prodigal.
All right, so Angel's still hurling himself against the meat locker, can't get out, and he tries punching through the molding. It doesn't work, and then he finds a metal mesh paneling and starts to try and peel it off. And then we cut back to Alana and Gunn. She says, we were on the right track, just the wrong team. All that rage and hatred we got, you get to keep all that, except on this side, no guilt, no grief, just the hunt, the kill, and the fun. All right, so Gunn says, Lana, I can't do this. Alana says, no, but you can fight and die in a bombed out building with a bunch of fool kids. This is where we belong, G. My God, you were made for this, which makes sense because this is a guy who's been this entire time saying how much he, like, death fascinates him, and she can tell that. And so she's like, well, is this not what you would want? And the heartbreaking part is that Gunn realizes that he has given her every reason to believe that this would be what he wants. And so that just leads, it's almost like a double betrayal when he has to stake her. And then, you know, showing that vampires still carry over attributes and characteristics of their human self. She says, all that misery and moping gone. I promise, she says, I can free you. We can be together. Our family can be together forever. What do you say? Like, let me rescue you, kind of thing, which is just so sad because you do see the evilness there, but you also see so much of the sister that he knew and loved as well.
But it's like, yeah, she's using it to, like, manipulate him at this point.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, like she's hitting him, like, where it hurts.
Yeah.
But.
All right. So Cordelia and Wesley end up getting Angel out of the meat locker. They're like, why didn't you just try calling us on your cell phone? And he's like, oh, you know, they hardly ever work. It's just easier. And oh, God, I'm the boss here. I say when we use the cell phones and people are going to die and I have to go and it just takes off. Angel was so weird this episode.
He was. He was in a very, like, silly, goofy mood for some reason. That line, I feel like Giles could have said that line.
Honestly. Yes, I agree. All right. So, and then Alana goes and does what you said, Leia. She's manipulating him, saying, you know, you protected me. Now it's my turn to protect you. And we're going to be together for forever. We don't have to run and hide anymore. Isn't this what you want? I'm going to fix everything. And then this heartbreaking moment where she leans in, she morphs into vamp face, leans in, says, say goodbye to everything you ever knew, goes to bite him. And I love that we have it from his perspective. We look at his face and he just says goodbye and stakes her. And it's just so heart-wrenching. We've barely known this character we haven't even seen him for a full episode yet. And yet already we want to know more. Already we are so attached to him. And yeah, this is just a wonderful way to introduce a character. And as she dusts, like as she disappears, we see Angel standing there right behind her. And I think it is so significant that Angel sees Gunn's lowest moment. And, you know, I mean, it's Gunn's sister, just like Angel killed his sister. The idea of found family after losing your blood relatives. And I mean, it's devastating that the vampires didn't even care about them, didn't even think they were worth eating, but that it was Gunn's death wish that drove them out and resulted in Alana's death. J. August Richards says this about the most challenging scene for him so far. He says, the scene where I had to go kill my sister was so challenging. That was the most challenging scene because it was my first day. It was the first thing I had ever shot on this show. And the pressure was just so great in terms of what the character was going through. It was so hard. I think it was a great moment for me because right before I did it, I discovered that my objective throughout the whole piece was to protect my sister. And in killing her, I think he felt that that was the last act of protection. So that's how I looked at it. So he was still doing something very heroic. It was still a positive thing because in his framework, her being a vampire is just about as bad as it gets. So he had to do it. The interviewer asked him if he thinks there was any waffling for Gunn, whether or not he was thinking about whether he should do it or should not. And Jay says, absolutely. I think the whole scene, I was spending the whole scene trying to figure out. Eric LaSalle told me, he said, you can never reach the climax until you've exhausted every other possibility. So throughout the scene, I think I was looking for things to see that my sister was still there. But when I saw that face, that vampire face, that's when I realized that she was gone. And that's when I realized I had to kill her. Isn't that crazy that that was the first scene that he filmed for Gunn ever?
Yeah, and I mean, it's crazy because all of that does really, like, come across on the screen. Like, you can see it in the way that he's acting in that scene, all of those things that he described.
Yeah, the fact that he was able to nail all of that in not just the first scene of the episode, but the first scene that he ever shot for that character, mm-hmm. and for him to be able to nail it so perfectly, that's just fantastic. All right. So the rest of the gang runs in, says, what are we waiting for, Gunn? And then they see Angel because it's been, 10 minutes. Gunn says, don't, we're leaving. Like, he's had enough death. And then all the other vamps come running in. They start taunting Gunn. They said, oh, she was so sweet, going down smooth. You know what I mean? And then Angel starts talking, as the script says, from the shadows to the vamps behind Nox, not looking at Nox. He says, here's the deal. You can go. If you go now and I never see any of you again, you get to live. LA is my territory. You'll want to stay out of it for the rest of your eternal lives. These kids, my town off limits from now on. And then Nox is like, who the hell are you? You know who you're talking to here, fool. So Angel stakes him and says, name's Angelus, and I actually wasn't talking to you. Okay, so Leia, thoughts. Why do you think he said Angelus? Because this is the first time that we've seen Angel refer to himself with that name.
I really don't know, to be quite honest. I don't know if it was meant to be like you were talking about the duality of the episode and how that was kind of being compared to Angel. I don't know. It's just such a weird choice. Maybe I think the thing that makes the most sense to me is that he's using his status as Angelus to be like, this is I am the alpha here. I am stronger than you, better than you, older than you. So you're going to listen to what I'm saying. Because I feel like that's with the word Angelus comes that fear. It instills mm-hmm. fear in even other vampires. So I think that's the most logical explanation for it that I can mm-hmm. think of. I don't know. What do you think?
No, that's what I think too. Because I was sitting here, I was like, why? I was like, it can't not be significant because this is the first time and Angel has mm-hmm. very intentionally not referred to himself by that name. It's always been names Angel or whatever. It's never been Angelus. Not to put it crudely, but it's kind of like a dog peeing on a hydrant to mark its territory.
Yeah.
I think that's his street cred. I think they intentionally did this because if we're talking about a gang war zone, he's trying to establish his territory, his name in this space. And by how they react to him saying Angelus, they seem aware of who Angelus is. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be less likely to attack him. So he's kind of putting a little bit of firepower behind his words. So I think this whole moment is meant to parallel the one at the beginning where we meet Gunn. I think the idea is that we're supposed to realize that Angel's making a name for himself and that demons are starting to fear him apart from his name, Angelus. When they turned and said you, and then Gunn says, were you expecting someone else? It's possible that the vampires were even expecting Angel too. And then they're showing that all the work that Angel's been doing at this point is not for naught. If that makes sense. Right. You know what I mean? Like it's he's actually starting to make a dent in LA. Like, people remember him and recognize him. And yeah.
Yeah. So, like, he's like, he has like ground to stand on when he says, this is my city.
Right.
And you're going to leave.
Yeah. He's someone to be feared for sure. Right. Yeah. I mean, it's possible that he uses the name Angelus towards those that have something to fear from him, and Angel is for those he rescues, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you really think about it, like, he wouldn't use the name Angelus when he's addressing humans because they wouldn't know who that is. But he would use it when he's addressing other vampires because other vampires are going to know about, like, one of the worst vampires in history. So, and then they're going to start quaking in their boots.
Right. Yep. Exactly. All right. So then Angel tells the other vamps, do you want a truce or do you want to die? Chain says, truce. We can take them. Angel says, they're probably going to take some of you. And then they say, Chain goes to Gunn, you're going to come all this way and not kill any vamps. And Gunn looks at Angel and says, I already did. Oh, man. All right. So then they all turn and disappear into the night. And then we have this shot of Wesley and Cordelia going to get cappuccinos. And Wesley's talking about how there's like too much foam on the top. And they keep talking about all those kids. And then Cordelia talks about how she might want to prostitute herself to the billionaire David Nabbit. This whole scene makes no sense except for the fact that they were going to try and make David Nabbit a reoccurring character, possibly someone they were going to move into the show. My guess is they might have been pushing a romance between David Nabbit and Cordelia, like eventually doing that because he is so wealthy. But apart from that, this scene makes no sense because it does
nothing.
This
scene is like either kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of tacky too, like not tacky but it's just like, why, like do we really have to sit there and refer to Cordelia as like a prostitute and that she's gonna prostitute herself? And like I don't know, it just kind of left a bad taste in my mouth. I was like, is this this is not like necessary, I don't think.
Yeah, I agree. And I'd like to say that it's a character development moment for Cordelia. Like, oh, look, she isn't – like, she's not choosing the money over doing this kind of thing. But it doesn't come across good for
her. It's just a very shallow scene that, like, seems like it was just in there to just be in there. I don't know.
Because once again, we're reducing Cordelia to simply the money aspect. But even then, she's over here going, oh, I wouldn't even take money to spend time with him because he's boring and not good looking. And so then it reduces Cordelia back to the shallow character that I think she's grown past or should be growing past at this point, you know? All right. But then we have a really good scene. So we have this lone figure looking out over the city that it kind of looks like Angel. Again, like these parallels. The script says it's not Angel still fighting the grief. Angel says, you okay? Gunn says, what are you doing here? Angel says, skulking professionally. Gunn says, look, I'm glad for what you did, okay, but I don't need a guardian angel and I don't need a talking to. It won't change the way it is down here. They're going to keep coming and we're going to keep fighting. Angel says, I know. And then Gunn says, that's it. You're not going to talk at me, be all daddy figure. I think he is. I think he is. Angel says, what am I going to tell you that you haven't already learned? And Gunn says, I killed her. She was the reason, man. How come you do it? How come you're out here? And Angel says, what else are we going to do? And then they both look out at the city. And then Angel says, I'll be around. Gunn says, I don't need any help. And Angel says, I might. Ooh, I love that. That's so good.
Do I smell a new ally? Perhaps.
Yeah. I really enjoy the parallels between the two of them, and I'm really curious to see where they're going to go with that because they're building him up like a really significant character.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I have a little bit of spoilers. So if you don't want to know spoilers for like the rest of the show, then you can just skip this part and everything. But I thought this was really interesting in light of Gunn's character and stuff. So we all know, for those of you who've seen the entirety of the show, we all know that the show ended pretty abruptly in season 5. And they were actually building up to a big arc for Gunn's character in season 6. And Leia, I don't know if you know this or not, but they like that's one of the things, like I know everybody always talks about Cordelia's character and how they feel like it was really like her arc was cut off and stuff. But I feel like personally that Gunn's arc was also cut off, possibly even more so than Cordelia's. It felt like they were going somewhere with him. And then it just, because the show ended, they just were never really able to go there. So according to J. August Richards, this is what they were planning on doing for him in season 6. So Gunn's fatal flaw is the pursuit of death. After staking Alana, he clearly has learned a lesson, though we see the effects of it fade over the subsequent seasons. According to J. August Richards, his guilt over his involvement in Fred's death in A Hole in the World would have led him to become a vampire in season 6. Eventually,
it did happen in the comics.
Yeah. Eventually, he was to have an epiphany about death, much like in this episode, and somehow stake himself.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that dark? Yeah. But it's kind of crazy. I honestly think that would have been so compelling because here's the man that's been drawn to death his entire life. And that's kind of what draws him to Angel and then wanting to have like purpose and intention and all that other stuff. Mm-hmm. And then he has a purpose in his life and he's going somewhere and then he falls back to rock bottom because of what happens with Fred and it leads him to becoming a vampire.
I don't know if I would have liked that for Gunn. I just feel like the direction that they were taking him in was really great in like season 2. And then season 3 was okay, but they kind of neglect Gunn, I find, mm-hmm. in the later seasons. They don't really he's really relegated to like love interest for Fred and then a part of a love triangle and literally the muscle. I mean, there's many instances that we're gonna come like on when we're gonna get there where they literally refer to him like he is the muscle and that's mm-hmm. like the biggest insecurity that he has. But like Gunn is like, I feel so much more than that. And it's almost like he gets reduced to that role and that's mm-hmm. like his insecurity. So I don't know if I would have liked that, to be quite honest. I feel like maybe had his entire arc been a little bit different because he comes in really strong, I feel. And then in season 2, obviously, he's really great. But then after that, they just really fumble the bag.
Yeah, I agree.
In my opinion. So I feel like if that would have been a terrible way for him to go out for me, because mm-hmm. I wouldn't have wanted him to like have gone through all of that and like being kind of shafted by the writers and then to just die that way.
Yeah.
It would have been more powerful if that was his arc in like season 2, for example, when he was still at like his height. I don't know. Yeah.
And maybe they weren't planning on leaving him there. Maybe that was going to happen in season 6 and then season 7 they would have had something else too. Like, right. You know, I mean, there was so much, like even Fred was supposed to come back in season 6. Yeah. Like it was not supposed to be Lyria, but Fred, you know, and so I don't know, but yeah.
I think in the comics, like in the Angel After the Fall comics, I haven't read them, but I'm pretty sure he gets turned into a vampire. But then when magic gets like destroyed, he turns back into a human.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm making this up. I don't know if that there's even a crossover between the Buffy comics and the Angel comics, but supposedly, yeah, he gets turned into a vampire, but then he gets turned back into a human eventually for some reason.
Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, and on paper, I'm like, ooh, I don't want that to happen to Gunn, but I would have been really interested to see how they would have got there right. And if they would have come back. Because I also don't see them killing off Gunn for good. Like, I could see them wanting to keep him around.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. It's just interesting. It's interesting that the writers had at least somewhere that they were going to go with Gunn. And I agree with you that they do fumble the bag with him. Mm-hmm. In seasons 3 and 4, they really did nothing with him. And then starting to come back somewhere in season 5. But the Buffyverse does do that where they kind of relegate some characters to the background for a season and then – but are still doing like minor things occasionally. Right. And then the next season, it's all about that character. So I wouldn't have been surprised if season 6, they were building it up to be more Gunn-centric, which is a shame.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a shame in general that even the material he does get in season 3 and 4 are more like love interest or like, oh, his insecurities that he's – or even in season 5, oh, his insecurities mm-hmm. that he's – you know, just the muscle and not really like smart or not really a part of the gang. And then in season five, he goes and like sells his soul to like Wolfram and Hart for a bunch of knowledge in his brain because he feels so, it's like Gunn is like more than that. Like he, mm-hmm. he was, when we meet him in this episode, he's already like a much more layered character.
Agreed.
And much more like secure within himself. So it's like, why give him these very like out of character insecurities, mm-hmm. in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. Tabby and Leah, when we watched Angel together, their biggest criticism for Gunn is it felt like the writers meshed Fred and Gunn together to the mm-hmm. point where you couldn't separate the two of them because there was so much going on with Angel and Cordelia and Connor that the writers just kind of mushed them together. They had all their scenes and all their story arcs had to do with each other. And that's where you really started to lose who both Fred and Gunn were as individuals.
Mm-hmm. I mean, all the characters, honestly.
Yeah, all the characters. And we'll get to that when we get to season three and four for sure. But
the weirdest like supernatural like soap opera ever.
It is. Yes. Yeah. So anyway, but I wanted to mention that because I thought that was really fascinating that they were going to go there with him. But I'm excited to talk about him further. So. Mm-hmm. All right, guys, that was Warzone, and I'm so glad that Gunn is here. I'm so glad that we get to start talking about him now. I get more excited the more characters get introduced, the more characters come in, because it's just, there's so much juicy stuff and storylines to talk about. So as always, guys, thank you so much for listening. Let us know your thoughts, and we will talk to you next time. Thanks so much for listening to Investigating Angel. If you enjoyed this podcast, feel free to follow, subscribe, and review us on all platforms. You can also find us on Instagram at Investigating Angel Podcast, and you can email us at investigatingangelpodcast@gmail.com.